coming up on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast.
Turns out, initial data are, is that MDMA is probably as helpful for early attachment trauma as it is for objective trauma, like specific events. And that, in my mind, is the biggest finding. Because up to now, we have really done, always struggled with, how do you get an imprint of being a lovable person if that's not something you came with you from your experience? And if I think ayahuasca can probably do it, and if MDMA can really do that, say, oh, that's what it feels like to be a love child. Oh, let me take that love child inside of myself. Then we really have a truly revolutionary treatment.
Welcome to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast, a weekly conversation series with leaders in psychedelic culture, designed for therapists, healers, retreat leaders, and passionate enthusiasts. Presented by Maya and hosted by me, Eamon Armstrong. Welcome back to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. Today I'm speaking with trauma specialist Bessel van der Kolk, best-selling author of The Body Keeps the Score, a beloved book about healing our deepest wounds. On the show, we discuss Bessel's work with MDMA therapy for trauma. We dispel the myth that PTSD is only something experienced by soldiers returning from war, and discuss how early attachment wounds can actually be more intractable to traditional treatment than acute trauma. We talk about why we get addicted to our own trauma, and we review other psychedelic compounds like ketamine and ayahuasca. At the end of the interview, after the outro music, Bessel generously addresses the unfortunate circumstances that led to him being fired by the Justice Resource Institute, answering a question suggested by our Psychedelic Therapy Facebook group. Bessel is an author, researcher, and sought-after public speaker. In addition to founding Boston's Trauma Center and his popular books, Bessel is also the principal investigator for MAPS's MDMA trials at its East Coast hub in Boston. Bessel, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to have you on, and I've been a fan of your work personally in my own work with trauma. I think many of our listeners will have read your book, which had an enormous impact on the field of trauma studies, The Body Keeps the Score, a book that I have been very fond of, which has only a short section on MDMA. I wonder if there might be another book forthcoming, and perhaps we'll talk about that. But anyway, welcome to the show. It's an honor to have you here. And just to get started, I think it would be really helpful for the audience to kind of locate a connection with you in your own experience with psychedelics. And so what sort of experiences have you had personally with psychedelics, and how have they changed your life?
Right. So I'm a child of the 60s, and like everybody I grew up with, basically, I did my share of LSD and mushrooms in college. Not a great deal. I was a pretty serious person, and did it responsibly and carefully with the right people around me. But, of course, we are curious. And I had, let's say, 3 LSD trips. 2 of them were mind-blowing in a positive way. 1 of them was mind-blowing in a negative way. And so I early realized that when you open up your mind to these substances, you get the good and the bad and the ugly. And so it's also important to create surroundings and do it with people who you can trust to make sure that you're okay. And what really struck me back then is that psychedelics gave me a sense of that we're living in a very circumscribed universe, and that these substances really can open you up to see things from very different perspectives. So I've always continued to be intrigued with that. And in fact, when I founded my residency at Harvard, I had Timothy Leary's old office. He was long since gone by then. And we did some marijuana research. That was also interesting. And then the whole field came to a stop. And I found myself living in a very straight world, and a world in which psychedelics were not prominent. And actually, I found myself eager to be a member of this faith world of science and Harvard and all that stuff. But I continued to be intrigued with substances. And in fact, in 1994, I organized a symposium at the American Psychiatric Association where I called together a lot of old LSD researchers who were still around, who had done research back in the 70s. And it was actually a very horrendous experience in that these guys were as depressed as anybody I've ever seen.
Wow.
And they basically said, we found these amazing things, and then we got criminalized, and we were doing this research, and we lost our academic positions, and nobody saw what we were doing. And I was sitting in this podium with a bunch of very depressed old guys. And that, of course, didn't really make it very encouraging. But at the same time, I kept my interest in it in a sort of in an abstract way, not personal way. And I have quite a few friends whose names are known in this field. And I've asked every one of my friends, did you do acid in college? And everyone of my friends said, yes, sure I did. And I said, so what impact do you think it has had in your life? And the most common answer of old friends is, you know, I think I would never have become the really creative scientist that I have become because LSD really helped me to open up my world, that there is more mystery and more stuff to the universe than meets the eye. And to a large degree, I think that's true for people of my generation, that we're, you know, I've trained a whole bunch of number of generations now of younger people, and they're caught into this. You have to do evidence-based treatments, even though very few treatments have been shown to be evidence, and they're much more constricted. And I think they're more constricted because they didn't have that experience as young people of like, boy, I'm just a smidgen in this gigantic universe, and whatever I know is just a fraction of what can be known. And I find people oftentimes, particularly in psychology, mind is so damn complex for people to say, this is the way it works. You go like, really? Like, you know? So my experience with drugs early on really opened up the reality that our minds are just unspeakably complex. I'm very grateful for that. But when Rick Doblin and Michael Mithoffer came to talk to me at some point, something like 15 years ago, and told me he wanted to do psychedelic research, I said to them, you're crazy. You'll never succeed because everybody who's done this work has become criminalized. And so I'm just astounded, actually, that Rick and Michael and whoever else is involved in it have been able to carry this out, actually. I'm really still incredulous that even in our current political situation, that this field is back alive and thriving, actually. It's very interesting to me.
Well, and I think that Rick Doblin was very wise to focus on PTSD and veterans as the population to do the trials for MDMA. Because when you think about trauma, the iconic image of a traumatized person is really a war veteran suffering from PTSD.
It's a very American perspective.
Certainly, certainly.
It has to do with our government, our funding, the crazy culture we live in. The rest of the world doesn't see it that way, of course.
Well, and as you've rightly pointed out, that, you know, there are many people who've experienced this kind of impact trauma of war and perhaps a natural disaster, but then there's also a kind of developmental trauma. Many people who've been abused as children are equally traumatized.
Actually, I'm very unhappy with the cultural stereotype of our soldiers having PTSD, because for every soldier who gets PTSD is at least 30 kids who get abused and neglected and messed up in their own families. And I think it has given us a cultural bias that is not good at all, actually. But another thing, side effect of having focused on veterans is that a lot of us, and you've had other people in this program, actually have been working on PTSD, and none of us is particularly negative or feels hopeless about treatment of PTSD. The only people who are negative about it are people at the VA, because the VA very early on came into this top-down thing, you have to do exposure treatment. Now, all of us who do this work in our offices, you think that exposure treatment doesn't work for most people. So people at the VA, because of the VA structure and the politics of the VA, believe that PTSD is an untreatable illness. Those of us who are not at the VA know much better than that and are actually quite optimistic about the outcome and not desperate for the results of psychedelic studies, because even if psychedelics would become illegal or whatever, we would still find ways of dealing with PTSD. But at the VA, they got stuck because of their politics, basically.
Well, and in your book, you talk about so many ways of dealing with trauma. And yep. I think one of the things that's popped up in the psychedelic renaissance and in working with psychedelic therapy generally is that these medicines can be really powerful in creating a sense of safety to process an experience or accelerating one's ability to connect with it. But that so much of the work is about integration. And when I read The Body Keeps the Score, there are so many elements in here that read like a manual of integration, you know, like yoga is a perfect example. So as you point out, you know, these medicines are really profound, but the integration piece, all of the different activities, the mindfulness, the yoga, how we're interacting with our communities, all of these things are an important part of healing trauma.
Yeah, I have not a serious reservation about this. And that is that we're in such a chemically driven culture. We think that medicine says, oh, if something's wrong with you, just pop a pill. And that's part of my own development, is that very early on, I did the first studies on psychotropic agents for PTSD, and they weren't bad, and I had very nice reputation because studying drugs as a psychiatrist, of course, is a very prestigious thing to do. But very quickly, I realized that drugs aren't the answer, and we need to go back into the mind and dealing with processing the memories. And the idea that you need to take a drug in order to change your mind, I have some problem with that. Because our culture is so, oh, let's pop something to make it happen. And I still suspect that there's other ways of getting people into these altered state of consciousness that are produced by ketamine and psilocybin, et cetera, that don't necessarily depend on people ingesting substances. I would like to caution all of us to say, oh, you need to take the magic pill to make this happen.
You know, I also feel that the magic pill doesn't do the work. You do the work, you know. But as you pointed out in your own experiences as a young man taking LSD, that there was a way that it allowed you to have a broader perspective. And in my own life, my own experience with psychedelics has very much been that way, is this broader perspective that then has to be integrated into my life through practices. It's almost like I'm, you know, I continue to unpack the journey, whether it's an ayahuasca ceremony or an acid trip or something like that. For me personally, I feel like some of the trauma that we experience in our lives is part of our birthright in a sort of wounded healer kind of way. We have something that happens to us, and then it allows us to evolve into these more profound and beautiful and potent creatures in this life, even though it's my trauma and it hurts and it's my wound, but there's a path that we work through that and then we can serve and heal and care for others. And that's been the experience that I've had with my own relationship to my trauma and a lot of the people that I've seen. And I think that's a helpful way of thinking about it. And I think these compounds, both in a therapeutic session or even if they're taken recreationally, these can be part of this overall healing journey that can lead to the gifts that you can then give to the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's also important here is this whole context issue. Huh? That the drugs can be taken to provide something to you, but boy, you better take it seriously. And one of the things that I really admire about Rick Doblin particularly, and then Michael as his companion, that it's psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy, that you... And the seriousness with which you create an atmosphere where you can really feel free to go to places where you have never dared to go before. Huh? But it's very much done with people being there for you, feeling that there is people who are completely devoted to you for some length of time. And you're not giving a pill to go off by yourself. It's very much, you create a place where you can really deeply go into yourself, surrounded by angels in a way.
I totally agree. And it also highlights, I think, one of the challenges of psychedelic medicine, which is the current protocols for MDMA that MAPS are doing for the clinical trials are extremely expensive. You know, having two practitioners there with you for an 8-hour period, it's a very expensive process. And I think there's a fear in the psychedelic renaissance that there will be companies, for-profit companies, that are trying to cut corners to make it a more profitable version of therapy, where they're taking out that, you just so beautifully stated, that experience of being surrounded by angels. There's a fear, I think, that it's too costly, it's too expensive to have that support network.
Yeah, I think that's a very serious fear. And of course, MAPS is very aware of that. It's working very hard to keep it sort of a closed system. An outsider might think, oh, they're too controlling, they're too possessive about it. But I would say, no, we better keep being very possessive about it, because one should do what Johnson & Johnson did with ketamine, for example. Just have people come in, you give them a pill and you send them home. That's not what we need to do and should be doing. And of course, it is expensive, but it's actually more expensive to have PTSD for 10 years as opposed to PTSD for a short period of time. Like the payoff, if the data hold up the way they seem to be holding up right now, the payoff is huge economically, because it's an expensive problem to have. It really messes up your life. It messes up the lives of people around you. It messes up so many aspects of your life. And if you can actually come into the clear with yourself and come to life in the here and now, that's incredible, of course.
So I think everyone listening to this program will have some idea that set and setting are enormously important for any kind of psychedelic experience. At the moment, we're talking about the MDMA clinical trials that MAPS are doing. So I think it will be helpful to just kind of focus on MDMA in this moment, although I'd like to speak about other psychedelics during this conversation. With an eye to the fact that the listeners are psychedelic practitioners themselves or aspiring psychedelic practitioners, you've just painted this picture of being held by angels. And I'm wondering, as one of the foremost experts on trauma, what are some of the things that are most important for a practitioner to be aware of when working with someone who is working through trauma in an experience of psychedelic-assisted therapy, specifically in this case, speaking of MDMA?
Well, you know, in contrast to what people are being taught in school, which is CBT type stuff, where we fix people's problems, or I don't even want to say we, because I'm so not part of that. But what MDMA and the other substances do is you create a place where people can do the work that they ordinarily cannot do. As a therapist, you don't try to fix anything. You just try to be there and create an optimal space for people to be as courageous and safe enough to go into the dark recesses of their minds and to feel what they feel without judgment, with complete acceptance, and with the trust that if people allow themselves to go there, something good will come out in terms of the revelations that you will get as you allow your mind to relax into the experience. And so it's a very passive experience. You know, like nobody says anything particularly clever. It's like, I love to show a tape of Mithoffers doing MDMA therapy. It's a beautiful tape. And then occasionally you say, wow, that's really good, or thank you for sharing. And I say, one of the best parts of this tape is that the therapist never say anything of particular interest. They're just there. And I think that's what this work is about. You just, you know, nobody outside of you is particularly clever or interesting. They just like your parents when you're a little baby. Whatever they say is not so interesting. They're just there for you, you know?
I, uh, I've done some work trip sitting at festivals with the Zendo Project. Are you familiar with trip sitting?
Yeah. I am. Yeah, my research assistant does that. Yeah, she tells me.
I got so much out of trip sitting. So it's exactly what you're saying. When you're trip sitting, you're not guiding anyone anywhere. You're simply gently affirming them and helping them with anything they might need. So, you know, whatever they're sharing, it's just a positive, warm, kind of going with where they are. And it taught me, you know, and I'm not a therapist, but it taught me how to be a better listener, how to support people who are suffering in my own life. With psychedelic-assisted therapy, there's such an art to being so completely present for such a long period of time while trusting the inner healer of that wounded person you're with, trusting their inner healer, offering them your trust so that they can feel that trust too, and just staying with it.
A good example is my own MDMA experience. I've been the principal investigator of the Boston arm of the study. I legitimately could take MDMA, so I had my own MDMA experience with Michael and Annie. And the preamble for this is something else. I have a friend who used to be the commissioner of child services in Massachusetts, who, when I met him, I was really taken with him. And I just said, how do you know all this stuff? And he just was a wise man. And he said, you know, Bessel, I went to Bolivia and had the ayahuasca experience. And all of the traumatized kids in the world came to visit me for a week. I go, holy shit. I can't think of anything more horrendous than all the traumatized kids, because I know, but I hear a lot of trauma stories, coming to visit you for a whole week. As she said, I was just, the women in the village were just holding me as I was crying and feeling all the pain, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, boy, I really admire you for having gone through that and saying that you came out of it. Damn it, I take my own MDMA and have a similar experience. All of my, I was always sort of poo-pooing vicarious traumatization. And I have my MDMA experience, and all of my traumatized patients come to visit me. And I lie there and I go, oh shit. Oh fuck. Oh my God. And I said, are you sure this is a party drug? And for 8 hours, I just felt all that pain that people have been unloading me all these years. And at one point, my body started to do things. And my wife, as a body worker, came in to sort of hold my body and work with me. And it was a very cleansing experience. But was it fun? Phew, nothing fun about it. And then Michael told me that he had had a similar experience at one point also. And so nobody could have said anything. But if I had experienced it by myself, I might have off myself. You know, to feel all that pain all by yourself is pretty harrowing. And I don't know how well I would have coped. But having these kind faces who just knew what they were doing, they've seen it before, they were there, and allowed me to say, okay, this too shall come to an end at some point, and it was okay. And overall, it became a very cleansing experience. But boy, wasn't fun.
I had an ayahuasca experience fairly recently where I was able to touch on some of my childhood trauma. And I went very, very deep. And it was a ceremony with a group of people. And I cried and I wailed and I released. And I was speaking to someone else in the ceremony afterwards. And I was like, yeah, I'm sorry. I was the loud guy in the ceremony. And she's like, I felt like you were crying for all of us. Have you yourself done ayahuasca?
I've not done ayahuasca, no.
So,
but yeah.
So ayahuasca for me is my favorite state of consciousness. The experience of being in community with everyone doing their own work, but together with the shaman, with the facilitator holding the space is so, so, so profound. And I think that you, with all of the experience you've had and everything that you've worked with over many years, I think you would get a lot out of that experience. I would highly recommend it.
Thank you. I'll take it. I'll take your advice seriously. But, you know, you're talking about a very, very important thing is that, you know, when you're traumatized, you feel so, and I see this oftentimes in my workshops that people say, I've been traumatized. But when you do this psychedelic work, you know that this is part of the burdens that we carry as human beings. and that your pain is the pain of millions of people before you and sadly billions of people after you. And this is just part of what it's like to be a human being. And this whole sense of I'm special or I'm special, that doesn't hold up, you know, because you just feel all that pain flowing through you and say, yeah, that's what people go through as a species. That's part of our life.
I had a conversation with an ayahuasca facilitator named Tony Moss. Tony is one of the people who I admire most in the psychedelic realm. And we spoke about ancestral trauma. And he spoke about a ceremony that he experienced, ayahuasca, where he saw his ancestors being loaded up on slave ships. And he saw the trauma passed from slavery through his lineage to his father hitting him as a child. And in that moment of seeing that trauma passed down, I'm getting chills just thinking about it. I have so much admiration for Tony. I hope Tony's listening because he's such an amazing man. He, in that moment, he could see that the trauma that he received from his father as a child was actually passed through him through an ancestral trauma. And he was able to release and just deeply forgive his father. And I'm curious how you feel about this idea of ancestral trauma.
But what you say really resonates with me, and it certainly happened to me, and I see it happen to everybody else who gets to resolve their trauma. At the end, you feel sad for your parents for not to have enjoyed this beautiful little boy more than they did. And that you say, if you hadn't been so traumatized, you wouldn't have been so uptight, you wouldn't have been so triggered, and you would have really just delighted in me as a kid, as I now have come to delight in myself as a kid in the way. And you could have had such a more joyful parenting experience. And so it's, people talk a lot about forgiveness, and I don't think it's about forgiveness at all. It's just getting that whole perspective of the burdens that everybody carries and the burdens that get passed on. And at some point when the burden goes, you go like, I feel sad for you that you hit your kid. That must have been awful for you, actually, to be so out of control and not know how to love that kid better, sort of thing. Absolutely.
And with this idea of ancestral trauma, I don't remember reading about ancestral trauma in The Body Keeps the Score. I don't know if you wrote about it or...
No, I didn't.
I'm curious if that's something that's been part of your work or if you've looked at, because it's something in psychedelic circles, we talk a lot about it. It's a very popular concept.
I did not go there in the book. It's interesting, I'm about to finish another book called Come to Your Senses, which is much more of a body-oriented workbook for The Body Keeps the Score. And I haven't gone there, but my friend Dick Schwartz, who you had on this program, is of course very much into it and very, very, very good about it, actually, also. It may be something I may get into further.
There's something that you said once, that trauma is not in our memories, it's in our reactions. And I think we are currently living in a world of traumatized people reacting to each other. You know, you look at the intense divisiveness of political perspective, we are getting triggered all the time. Social media is just mainlining outrage into our wounded trauma and our hypervigilant amygdala. We are a traumatized people. And I believe that psychedelics, not a magic pill, but I think are a huge part of the healing of our species and are resurging at a time when we need them most.
That's an interesting perspective. I wouldn't say that yet. I just say that's a nice perspective. And I'm reminded of my principal teacher in psychiatry, Alvin Sembrat, who used to say, hate makes the world go round. You know, and it's very exciting to talk about our president and the horrible person that he is. And the world really is very much back into finding people to hate in a way. It's very, very, very striking because, you know, 10 years ago, we were so collectively in a much better spot around the world, actually. And now everybody needs to go back into excitement and hating, et cetera, et cetera. And I I would take what you say seriously, that maybe the psychedelic world will help people to go like, no, I don't need to hate. Hate is, I can really feel very deeply without hating. And it's about people being numbed out. And when you feel numbed out, you need to do very exciting things to make yourself feel alive. And that's very much our culture. We're so overstimulated. Our bodies are so shut down that we need to find new ways of getting excited about. And I could well see how the psychedelics might really be very important things to turn us back into ourselves. Yeah,
there's a sensitization to the lived experience that I think is really lacking. Social media is giving us this constant dopamine drip of variegated validation, and what we watch and what we eat, and we're like hyperstimulated and numb at the same time. And one of the things that psychedelics are so profound about is just connecting us with the majesty of the natural world, ayahuasca especially.
This is a very interesting issue for me. I wish we would study all this much more precisely, actually, because the very first paper the second paper I wrote about trauma, I talk about addiction to trauma. And over time, and as part of my interest in doing the MDMA study, is that people get very hooked into, I'm a Vietnam veteran, I was in Iraq, and they define themselves by the horror of their past, and that the horror of the past makes them feel alive. And so when they pay attention to anything else but their combat or their incest or their child abuse, they don't feel very alive. But when they go back there with their indignation, their horror, and their pain, the horror and the feeling alive come together in the same place. And I think people get hooked on their trauma. And I think that the agents that we talk about might really help people to lay it to rest and to see, yeah, that's a part of what happened to me. But now look at that butterfly flying over there. Look at that leaf that is sprouting. Look, I mean, that is really the nature of these experiences. If you get fascinated by the smallest evidence of life and growth and how things feel connected. And I think part of it is that you really get to see, yeah, that little boy got very hurt. That was part of what happened to that boy. But you don't need to go and revisit it over again. You sort of like, okay, that's what happened. It's very interesting. I think we should look much more carefully in that. And we're not doing that enough of how do these agents help people to reconfigure their taking in the moment-by-moment experience of their lives. Mm.
This idea of being addicted to trauma is really interesting. Many of us are on these profound healing journeys, and we get kind of addicted to not just the trauma itself, but like our own personal mythologies. You know, I'm on a hero's journey to heal this great wound. And if I'm not healing this great wound, then who am I? Then what am I doing? And I think there's a lot of the identification with the wound, not just, as you said, and as you also wrote in the book, the feeling of being alive when connected to the horror, but there's also this feeling of, I think, attachment to the identity of not just a traumatized person, but also even someone who's on a healing journey, someone who's chasing peak experiences for healing, but kind of in a bit of like a cul-de-sac. Have you noticed that at all in the work that you've seen that people are doing?
It's very interesting you say that, yeah. I think that's, I have quite a few friends who do Burning Man, including my kids also. I haven't done it myself. I know how large that world is. I mean, you know that world better than I. Now, in the world that I live in, it's more like, I'm going to find the answer to this scientific problem. We have these heroic things. And then I went for a long bicycle ride and stopped at a bunch of farms and got some veggies from the local farmers here. I said, you know, it's beautiful what you guys are doing. They're just growing a bunch of vegetables. And it's beautiful how they are completely devoted to something that's nothing extraordinary. And it's just beautiful that he take care of the small things of life. And that's the people who we love best. Huh? The people we love best are the school teachers who just love to teach kids, and the potters who just love to make pots, and the car mechanics who just love to do them with car mechanics. But we live in a grandiose world. Yeah.
I think people who seem satisfied with the world as it is are very endearing, because I think ultimately we all would like to be more satisfied with the world as it is.
And excited about it, excited about teaching these kids, excited about building that piece of furniture, etc.
So I wanted to talk a little bit more about the experience of trauma. And I'd like to just for a moment speak of my own in a way that might be helpful. And so I have an attachment wound. My father was an alcoholic when I was a little boy, and I have trouble with love and attachment. And my trauma shows up where I'm hypervigilant to criticism from my partner. And when I feel criticized, I can get hijacked, go offline, and feel like I'm a little boy. I can't remember things very well. And I had a therapist say, well, do you know, this sounds a bit like PTSD. I was like, I didn't go to a war. That's not PTSD. But I've come to understand that this is a trauma reaction. And so I'm using, it definitely is. It definitely is a trauma reaction. Right.
That's what most people suffer from.
I think it's super common, you know, these reactions that we can't really control, and that we seem like this idea of getting hijacked. And so this is an example of a kind of trauma that I think is helpful to use. How should someone like me work with their own trauma and potentially, you know, this is a little off the topic of psychedelics as a way of dealing with trauma, but how do you counsel friends, people in your life, or maybe your own relationship to trauma? How do you work with your own trauma?
See, I don't think it's off the topic of psychedelics, because what really got me interested in MDMA, of course, I have a whole bunch of friends, colleagues, students who talked about the wonders of ecstasy, and I was always open to it, but never took it myself. But what everybody agrees on is MDMA puts you in a position of self-compassion.
Mm.
And the issue of self-compassion is the big issue. And of course, if you live in the attachment wound, you don't fundamentally feel like a lovable person. You don't feel deeply cherished. And to my mind, the mode of action, and again, I wish we would look at it more precisely and to see what different agents do in this regard. I'm really interested. I'd like to talk about ketamine, not as an expert, but I'm really puzzled about ketamine, because I get MDMA. MDMA does something about making you deeply compassionate to that creature that you inhabit. And you go like, that kid was beaten, that poor kid. And then you go into what Dick Schwartz does. And it's so interesting, this marriage of IFS and the psychedelic world, of feeling, oh, let me take care of that little boy. Let me go there and cherish that little boy. That's who I am. That's the boy who lives inside of me. Let me cherish that creature inside of me. And so that's very much, to my mind, an extraordinary contribution of MDMA. I wish we would pay more attention to that, because I think that's the wound we're healing. And so the VA world got very involved in this whole design of the study. So they say, what is your index trauma? But most people don't have an index. I mean, that's a fiction that we created in order to create the diagnosis of PTSD, which came from the military, that, oh, let's look at the index trauma, and because that happened to you, you are 30% service disabled, and because of that, you will get a pension for the rest of your life, which is completely determined by social conditions. Today we know, and that's something we saw back then, because I was part of the people who sort of put it together back then, we saw all the childhood trauma, but we very deliberately left it out.
Mm.
But war trauma, the childhood trauma, that I'm fundamentally defective, I'm fundamentally unlovable, I'm not a terrible person. And this is not about what the index trauma is. There are a few people who are adults who have those experiences, and it's very treatable, actually. You don't need to do psychedelics with people who have clear adult traumatic experiences. You know how to treat that. But it's these old wounds of not feeling cherished, not feeling loved, and that really builds on top of the other. And then every subsequent event becomes larger because it happens to this unloved person inside of you. But that abandoned child is at the center. And I think MDMA is spectacularly helpful to actually go there. It's interesting. I'm a little bit ahead of the data here, and I'm not sure if Rick and Michael will, they're talking about it. When I got involved in an MDMA study, I'd done EMDR research and yoga research stuff. And what we found is that if you had a decent childhood and you got traumatized, EMDR was spectacularly helpful, like 82% cure rate in 8 sessions. But if you had childhood trauma, the attachment issue, we didn't solve that in a few sessions of EMDR. And so when I got involved in the MDMA study, which was fairly late in the game, I said, you know, you should not get people with this very early childhood trauma, because that's not trauma. It's about the attachment system. It's a, are you cherished? Are you valued? And that is different from what happened to you. Mm. It is more what is the context that you grew up in that make you feel like, well, I'm pretty sure my grandchildren feel like they walk into a room, everybody starts smiling, and they go like, but they're cute. And you go, yes, you are cute. You know, like, and in some ways, that is the birthright that every child should have. I'm cute. I'm adorable. I'm smart. I'm interesting. There's nothing extraordinary about being a child who gets that. But if you don't get it, and instead people are drunk and beat you up and are depressed, that's a hard thing. So I encourage people to only get people who had a very pretty good pre-morbid personality, and then the trauma happened. And I was nixed. My idea was neglected. Turns out, initial data is that MDMA is probably as helpful for early attachment trauma as it is for objective trauma, like specific events. And that, to my mind, is the biggest finding, because up to now, we have really always struggled with how do you get an imprint of being a lovable person if that's not something you came with you from your experience. And if I think ayahuasca can probably do it, and if MDMA can really do that, say, oh, that's what it feels like to be a love child. Oh, let me take that love child inside of myself. Then we really have a truly revolutionary treatment.
You know, Bessel, I was worried that I would make this interview too personal because I have such a relationship to this material, but I'm realizing it's actually perfect that I have a relationship to this material, because many of us do. And I love this point that you're making here, is that the early childhood attachment is this kind of root trauma, and it can make the whole process of healing more intractable. You were saying that EMDR doesn't work as well with this deeper root trauma of this feeling of rejection as a child. And I think that what a lot of people go through is that they maybe have that deeper root suffering, that deeper root imprint. And then there are traumas later that they're trying to work with, but they're not getting to the root of that core wound.
That would be my thesis, that for many people, that is the case. What does it feel like to be cherished, to walk into a room and to feel safe?
Well, and so to bring this back to the psychedelic practitioner and therapist here, it seems like MDMA is a very profound substance for helping someone have a lived experience of safety and connectedness. And so it does seem like this drug is enormously helpful. What do we do to really keep that going, to keep that imprint going? You know, say I'm in the therapy session, I'm feeling all of this warm connectedness, I'm going to experience and relive where I felt rejected and where I felt hurt. So what can the therapist then do to help me keep that feeling going as long as possible, to help me integrate that into my life, to actually make fundamental lasting change out of an 8-hour MDMA experience?
Well, it's interesting, because now we are actually, my own personal practice, beginning to combine my two favorite practices. One is MDMA, the other one is psychodrama.
Oh.
And the psychodrama we basically, in three-dimensional space, recreate the scenes of childhood, like my drunken father and my cowering mother and my little brother who went off to juvenile detention center, but not my story, but and it's out there, and the feelings come up, become very lively, and then we create fictional characters where they choose a real person in the room and said, will you play my ideal father? And then we start serving, where would you like to have had your ideal father? And it takes a while to say, yeah, hold me like this, feel like, yeah. And then this person says, if I'd be your dad at age 3, I would have held you like this. They would have read bedtime stories to you. And you implant a new memory in people's minds. And I think implanting that reality in people's minds of making them very aware of, this is what it feels like to be safe as a child. This is what it feels like to make people smile. It's a very profound experience. And I think ideally I would sort of combine these two modalities in treatment.
Oh, okay. So someone would actually be on MDMA while they're experiencing the psychodrama?
It would be interesting to see it. I find the psychodrama very effective as it is. Too complicated to do research in because it's too many factors. But I think if people were in MDMA, it would be even deeper. Yeah.
And do you think...
But I've never seen this.
Yeah. Do you think that, so you said it would be a difficult thing to study. Do you think that once MDMA is past the third phase of the clinical trials and it is being used in therapy more frequently, do you think we'll see people experimenting beyond, say, I know a lot of the work has been with internal family systems. Do you think that we'll see people moving into these other kinds of modalities of healing along with the MDMA?
See, my hunch is that happens anyway. Nobody knows what's being practiced out there. There's no body of knowledge that's happening because it's all on the ground in a way. But I imagine there's people who are holding people while they go through it and give them a physical experience of physical safety. The thing that's missing from my point of view in the current research is that... My book is called The Body Keeps a Score, and that's because the body keeps a score, and because these are very somatic reactions. And people get very somatic reactions in their psychedelic treatments also. They wish we would pay more attention to helping people to help their bodies to come down, and we would train people to actually work with the body, which is actually the subject of the book that we're just finishing right now. And it's not the mental process, but it's the feeling in your body, oh, this is what it feels like to feel safe. This is what it feels like to go to bed as a little kid after your dad or mom reaches this bedtime story and you dream about whatever. And I think, you know, this field is always filled with creative people. So somebody is going to be doing it. To what degree it will become research-based at some point, God knows. But these things will happen. These things will evolve.
Something that you pointed out was actually a really powerful breakthrough in my own healing and growth. The idea that the brain is developing over time and that you're really young, and if you have a wound when you're really young, it's actually in a deeper part of the brain. And so when your prefrontal cortex develops, you can be an incredibly brilliant person and you can manage all of these concepts in your mind, but you can't get the trauma with the brain that the trauma is not in. You know, you can't think your way out of trauma. And that's been a really powerful realization for me.
Yeah. I'm utterly not a cognitive therapist. I also, if I would do MDMA therapy, I wouldn't explain anything. But might I amplify experiences? Yes. And that's, of course, what the protocol that we do right now also does. People listen to the right music and they have the right atmosphere. But it's really about having a visceral experience of safety and belonging.
And that's just the name of the game, I think, with psychedelic therapy, is that feeling of safety and belonging and being able to just feel it. And I think for a lot of the people who are going through these treatments, they might not have felt it before in their lives in a really complete way. And that might be why the healing is so long lasting. Because when you make that change, then you can do the integration of making these changes in your life. Well, I do deserve to eat in a way that nourishes my body. My body deserves care. I deserve care. And that can be this positive spiral of healing, which I think we see a lot in this work.
But what would be interesting is if people who have done a lot of previous therapy, but I really understand, like, yeah, my father this, my mom this, and blah, 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 blah. If that would be a good preparation for MDMA or ayahuasca, so that when you have these experiences, it's all linked up to stuff that you know already. That frontal lobe is quite important, actually, and that frontal lobe still needs to make sense out of what's happening. And so if you have done previous therapy, you go, oh, there it is. Oh, okay, now I make the connection. So it would be interesting to see if good initial therapy would really amplify the MDMA experience.
Well, I can tell you, as someone who has done a lot, I've done a lot of therapy and I've done a lot of psychedelics. I would say the answer to that in my experience is yes and no, in that yes, I'm able to connect certain things, but it's also a hindrance in a sense because my mind, my clever adult mind, is actually in part designed to keep me away from my pain. So I'm very—
That's right.
Exactly. I'm very good at hoodwinking my therapist. So I think it's helpful to know these things, but also if your human organism is so designed to get away from that feeling of pain, then can feel very impenetrable. And that's where I think, actually, to kind of shift away from MDMA, that's where some of the other psychedelics, I think, are really profound. Those that really disrupt the default mode network. You know, LSD, mushrooms, for me, ayahuasca is the big one, because that can help you break out of these personal mythologies that you have and allow you to be like, oh, it just hurts and I'm just going to feel the hurt.
No, it's not just mythologies, because it does, these networks go very deep into the deeper survival part of your brain also. And so the latest research from my former student, Ruth Lanius, who I think is the best neuroscientist in this area, she just presented at my conference, really mind-blowing material, is that when you're traumatized, that default network goes back, is most robust when you're in your trauma.
Oh.
And so you feel most alive and real when you're in that trauma mode. And so that the implication of that is that you really need to have your mind blown. You need to blow up the default network in order to rearrange it so you can actually take in new realities.
Mm.
The sentence I just said is actually a very serious sentence, actually. I think that is necessary to overcome trauma. If you need to, something needs to blow up the reality that you have gotten stuck in.
Well, the parlance of my world is we call that one the ego death. Do y'all talk about the ego death on your side of things?
But it's a complicated thing, of course, because I'm also an IFS practitioner, and we believe in self and a sense of self and who I am and what they stand for is also very important. So we're not anti-ego people at all. And I think it's actually a lot of traumatized people have lousy egos. They don't know what they stand for. All they know is that I'm traumatized, so you need to treat me with more consideration than anybody else because I easily get hurt. Yeah, like, I'm sorry you easily get hurt, but I really believe in doing what I'm doing is a very important gift to have. And that creates good lives. Is that, yeah, I'm going to really go to have a relationship with you, and you and I are going to really do it together. Or I'm really going to build this house. I'm really going to become a doctor. Or I'm really going to, whatever you do, psychedelic therapist, like, you know, and that's what I'm going to devote myself to. So that building up of that core sense of self is actually very important. So I'm not an ego death type person. I think you need to have your mind blown to see that where you got stuck in is a small part of the larger universe, but you also need to have a very good internal sense of this is who I am and that's what I stand for. This is what's important to me.
You know, here's another recommendation for you. I would love to hear what you have to say about an experience with 5-MeO-DMT. Are you familiar with 5-MeO-DMT?
I've read about it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I like to talk about it like speed dating with God. You basically get, if you take a high dose of it, you get a pretty like dissolved state for, you know, maybe 20 right. minutes. And it's a total blast off. And the experience I had with it that was most robust was the experience of being God, observing myself. And so when you talk about the big self, the true self, you know, we're getting into some metaphysical territory here, but I think that when you get your little self out of the way, you can kind of view the being that you are through this bigger self that may be even bigger than your own individual ego. It may be metaphysically that kind of oceanic non-dual state of the absolute self. And I just would be curious what you or Dick or others who've worked with internal family systems, I'd be curious what you'd report back after a strong experience with something like 5-MeO-DMT.
I very consider myself a student of this. And so the other experience I've had is I've had a number of ketamine experiences.
Oh, that can do it too, and yeah.
Ketamine put me in a state akin to what you described. And so yourself disappears and your body disappears. And so there's nobody there. You're just being hurled through the universe. At least that was my experience. And, you know, I was in lovely surroundings, lovely people. So it worked out quite well. But I have a hard time knowing what to do with that, except that my wife said that afterwards I was a much gentler and more considerate human being. Mm. I didn't feel gentler. So I don't know. Was I? I don't know. I didn't own the experience. And so having your ego disappear is something I still need to experiment with, because I actually like having an ego and I like having a body also. Mm.
Well, I think it's nice to visit other places and then be able to come home. You know, like it's nice to be in the place of no body and then be able to come home.
My problem is that I did not remember where I'd been.
Oh, after the ketamine, you forgot?
So I just had an experience, but I had no imprint of it in my mind in a way. Mm. But something may have changed, but it didn't own it in any way. I'd like to hear more people's opinions about it, like yours possibly.
Well, you know, actually, that's one of the things that I lament about ketamine. I think ketamine's a bit of a trickster molecule. It's not a naturally occurring substance, or, you know, someday maybe we'll find something in the jungle that is, you know, an analog to ketamine. But ketamine to me is, it's like the pharmacon. It's like it could be the medicine, it could be the poison, it could be good, it could be bad. As far as I understand, ketamine is the only psychedelic that's physiologically addictive. So there are people who actually get physiologically addicted to ketamine, and it is an addiction that you can be totally lost in. People doing intravenous ketamine all day. Like, it's a horrible thing to be addicted to ketamine, really horrible. And yeah, I know, right? And it can give you this oceanic, you know, this experience. But as you've just pointed out, you can then kind of forget it. And if you have a profound psychedelic experience, but you don't even remember it, it has a certain kind of, it's like ontologically masturbatory in a way. It's like you're having this experience, it's magical, it's, you know, you're hurtling through space or whatever, but you come back with no memory of it, you know, what actually occurred. And I think ketamine's a tricky one. I see it definitely is clearly helping people with depression. And, you know, maybe we'll see that actually if all of these substances were available and were used in their right setting, we might see that something like ayahuasca or something else might be even better for depression. But it is helpful for depression. But to me, there's something about ketamine I just don't fully trust. It's just, there's something about it. So I feel like we've wandered into the realm of the interview where we're just kind of geeking out around psychedelics, which I knew would happen, but it's an interesting thing.
Well, but I'm curious because I'm quite friendly with quite a few people who really are into ketamine, and they haven't been able to really nail them down on this very much. Like when you say, like I remember my LSD experiences, like, and they have always stayed with me, and I know what the world looks like to. I was living in Hawaii at the time, and I loved living in Hawaii. And I was about to go to Chicago, which was a tough place to go to after Hawaii. Obama got away with it, but I didn't. And I sit there on Tantalus Heights in Honolulu, tripping, and I see this blade of grass. And the blade of grass says to me, I'm a blade of grass, and my job is to be growing here on Tantalus Heights. and your job is to go and become a doctor. And I got this clear communication that we need to be who we are supposed to be. And I went off to medical school. And it really helped me to clarify that I had a job to do. And everything I learned in LSD never quite disappeared. It was really a very profound experience that that became part of me and a very comforting part of me for the rest of my life, that I could always see magic. Maybe I'd always been able to see magic before LSD also, but boy, it certainly helped me to see magic more profoundly after that.
I've had one of those with ketamine. My cat, who I was very attached to, got cancer. And I did ketamine around that time. And I had this incredible experience of understanding that my cat was a cosmic being. This is going to sound very silly, but it was very true for me.
Well, exactly. I can really relate to
that. It was what I learned in that moment is that she was a cosmic being. She was here in this world to do her own cat stuff that I couldn't possibly understand, but also to give me certain gifts, that her time here was done. She was ready to leave. She was grateful for me to be her owner and her human, and that she just asked that I give her a really sweet and quick passing. And I did a ceremony, and we did, you know, she had terminal cancer, but I didn't give her chemotherapy. I didn't do the whole thing. We did a ceremony. I had someone come to the house. We did a full ceremony with my little cat, Ella, and I transitioned her into her next experience. And if I hadn't had that ketamine experience, I think I would have held on to her more tightly, and it would have been more about me and less about letting her go. And this is another thing I've learned from ayahuasca too, is just like letting death and letting go. Psychedelics are very good for that kind of letting go. And so I've had some ketamine experiences where, like you've said, I've gone away, I come back, I don't even know where I was. It doesn't feel profound. And I think that's an indication that maybe ketamine's not my medicine or not my ally. But on that occasion, at that time, in that moment, that was the molecule that allowed me to understand what my cat needed from me. And it was really profound. It's very helpful. And similar to the blade of grass that said, hey, you know, your job is to go be a doctor and you can remember it all this time in the future. Now, in this conversation, share it with me.
Now, I think the story about your cat is very meaningful to me. And if people listen to this program, I think a lot of people relate to that. That's a very big thing for people. People really get devastated by the loss of their pets, and to be able to say, they came into my life and thank you very much for being here, and then yet go on. And everything keeps transitioning in life. And indeed, that's the experience of psychedelics, is the transitoriness of things and the essential stability of the universe, of which you are a very small part. I think all of our high government officials should have a lengthy LSD experience before they take office to really see, I'm just a small part of a larger universe. You know, In politics, we deal with all these gigantic egos. And the only solution is for people who take high office, before you get your job as university president or running a map study, or that people have a good psychedelic experience. So they have a good sense of, I'm just a part of this very large universe, and I'm here to do a temporary job, and everything is transitory. It's very important for us to have a very deep sense of the transitory nature of ourselves and how all we can do is the best we can, but how we are a very small part of a very large universe that's vastly more complex than who we are. And I think that's what all these substances do for us.
Well, and that's why I think that these molecules have emerged in the landscape of the human species at this pivotal moment when we need more than anything in the world to understand that we're a small part of a bigger whole. Now, psychedelics are not going to do the work themselves in the same way they don't in therapy. You have to do the integration. So having that great oneness is not going to change what's going on with the climate. It's not going to draw down carbon. But if we can see that we are this small piece, and that we listen to the blade of grass that says, you go be a doctor, and we listen to these moments, I think that we're going to see the change that we need over time, and that it's going to be a powerful technology for humans. And that's why I think this work is so important.
See, I love your optimism, and I hope that nothing I do or say to you will have any effect on that whatsoever. My problem is, people say, we're going through this revolution. I was part of the first revolution. And the first revolution ended very badly. And so I'm a very cautious person when it comes to that, that people did not learn from the previous experience. It was killed off. It was just astonishing to what degree all that knowledge went on the ground. You know, my generation, everybody read Carlos Castaneda. Everybody believed in Carlos Castaneda. Disappeared. Nobody reads him anymore. So I hope it will last. That's actually part of what I love about maps and Rick Doblin's approach is he is very careful. And I really love that because the disappointment about how badly it ended up last time is so great. And boy, when you have such a powerful agent, you really want to make sure that this consciousness stays around. You know?
Well, Bessel, this feels like a place to land today. I have really enjoying talking to you. And I feel like I could, there's so many other substances to talk about. We didn't talk about, you know, we haven't talked about peyote yet or, you know, whatever. But yeah. The way I like to finish every one of these podcasts is to just take a moment for you to speak directly to the psychedelic facilitators, the healers, the retreat leaders, the people listening who are helping this healing and who've been listening to your words and listening to this conversation. So if you could speak directly to those folks who are doing this important work, what would you most like to say?
What I most like to say, and I think I'm very glad that my team in Boston actually seems to be pretty good at that, is to really be there with the people you work with and give it your all. Just be there totally, but also observe what it does and what it doesn't do. Mm. I find that people tend to have a tendency to become religious about things. Say, we have found the answer. And what's very clear to me is that different people respond to different things. And that up to now, it looks like, you know, I don't have all the data, but overall, our MDMA subjects in our study have done extremely well and surprisingly well. And so people have an enormous life force and these drugs can unleash those life forces. And we are really servants to the life forces. But what I also very much would like people to do is to observe what changes, what shifts are being made. How have people's relationships changed? What's their relationship to work like? What's their relationship to sleep, to food, to sex? How do these things change? And as long as we get stuck with diagnosis, does it change PTSD? Does it change depression? We're really not measuring what changes in the core makeup or the soul, if you will. Huh? So what shifts inside? And I think some of the things you mentioned, like your cat, I think that was a very important issue, that you were able to not make it about you, but to make it about, I'm just part of this experience, and it allows me to just be there, to be a servant to this larger experience. So I hope that a lot of people will be very articulate about what their experiences are and to what degree you can generalize from one person to another.
I love that. Thank you. Bessel, it has been such a pleasure. It's so fun to get to talk to you because I've been with your work very deeply and I'm with it now in my life. And I have one request, which is if you do end up doing an ayahuasca ceremony, I would love to have the opportunity to interview you afterwards. Ayahuasca is my favorite medicine. There's nothing like it in my experience. And I would just love to know what a mind like yours experiences in that particular place. So please let me know if you decide to do a ceremony.
Thank you for your encouragement because I think I'm open for another mind exposing experience. But thank you for that. And I will let you know if I do it.
Beautiful. Okay. Well, thanks again for your time and your wisdom. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks for the interview.
Okay. Take care.
Good luck to you.
Thank you for joining us on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast.
If you enjoyed this show, please join the Psychedelic Therapy Facebook group to talk about it. You can also share it with your friends or leave a review on iTunes so more people can discover the show. The Psychedelic Therapy Podcast is presented by Maya, a platform designed to help psychedelic therapists manage and measure client journeys. You can head to mayahealth.com to learn more. The show is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide mental health or medical advice. Thanks for listening. First of all, I just want to say thanks for jumping on again to have just a little addendum conversation with me. I appreciate it.
Well, I'm really glad you asked me about it because it's such a horror story. It was very bad for my reputation out there. But I won my law case against JRI for defamation and all that and got a substantial settlement so I could start my new organization because they were wrong and I was right. So it's a very big deal.
I'm just going to set the stage by sharing with you how this past week has been for me on this subject. So we did the interview together and it was, as I'm sure you recall, quite a playful and fun interview. We went to a lot of interesting places. And when I was asking about this conversation, I got some pushback from our community on our psychedelic therapy Facebook group. And there were allegations that you had created a toxic work environment. And people were saying, you know, how can this specialist on trauma have created trauma for others? And actually in that thread itself, people who had experienced trauma felt triggered. And there was a sort of online trauma experience that folks were having in the group itself. And so it was just really incumbent upon me to take a step back and just kind of reappraise how I wanted to approach this. And I'm so grateful that you are willing to take the time to address it on the podcast, because I think that's the most open-hearted, transparent way to do it.
Yeah.
I think what would be helpful is if you could just set the stage as to what happened at the trauma center that led to your termination, and then ultimately what happened with the lawsuit and kind of where you are now.
Right.
Because there is still out in the ether this idea that Bessel van der Kolk created a toxic work environment. And I want to give you the opportunity to address that today.
Great. So let me give some background. So the things I'm proudest of in my career is that I've always focused on the next generation and knowing that one's usable lifetime comes to an end and that many people who make a big contribution don't have successors. So about 15 years ago, I turned over the management of the trauma center to some of my former postdoctoral students who are about a generation and a half below me and gave up my own administrative responsibilities and stepped back and was sort of a presence, but not really a person running it. Then I took a sabbatical to write my book, The Body Keeps Score. And while I was gone, the executive director of the clinic, there were a number of allegations against him about bad behavior. I came back from his sabbatical. I heard about it. I met with the overarching director of the organization to which the trauma center belonged. And I agreed with him that the executive director needed to be fired for what he had done and that we needed to immediately go do a nationwide search for a successor. And then an astonishing thing happened is that I came back to his office after teaching in Australia or something, we were supposed to talk about it. And he said, I am firing you and holding you responsible for what an executive director did. And it happened on your watch and you should have done something about it. Now, what turned out is that this guy who fired me was the direct supervisor of the executive director for many years, who I heard later had received numerous complaints about this guy that I've never heard about. So the moment I was suddenly fired, my entire senior staff went to meet with him to protest the thing. And he said, I need to do this to mitigate my own legal responsibility, i.e. I need to blame Bessel for my not supervising this guy properly, otherwise my ass is on the line. And my entire senior staff resigned, left the trauma center. Some younger people who who had no other sources of income, stayed behind. And the interesting thing is that just before this whole firing thing happened, the executive director and I and some other people had written some very big grants that we happened to get shortly after this disaster. And we got grants worth $7 million. So suddenly the clinic that was decapitated was an extremely rich clinic. And I thought they would certainly be able to keep it going with the amount of money that they now had. And then I heard 3 months ago that the trauma center had closed and that nothing was left anymore. So they couldn't keep it together despite all the infusion of money. So the result is that all the senior people left and people were so... So what they had always done, the trauma center had been a center where I encouraged people to develop a variety of different treatments. So ARC came out of the trauma center, SMART came out of the trauma center, and we were starting to do psychedelic stuff. And what I've always been very much in favor of is have a center where people actually see a whole variety of different patients and have a lot of clinical experience, but they also become researchers. And as such, we were pretty much the only institution in the world where clinicians were trained to be researchers, and every researcher was also a clinician, so they could marry the two of them. So a number of people who worked for a trauma center developed these independent methods, and when this disaster happened, everybody went off with their own method and sued the parent organization to be allowed to keep their own method. So ARC and SMART and Neurofeedback all became separate organizations. I tried to keep them together. People were too frightened about what happened to stay together. I sued JRI. I had like 100 letters from people who had worked with me over the years protesting how outrageous their treatment was of me. And so as a result of this hue and outcry of people who actually knew me very well, they settled the case, and I basically got all the money back that I had accumulated over the year for research purposes, and that was straight moved from JRI into the Trauma Research Foundation, and that now is the core of the new organization that I'm running.
Mm. And it's such a shame about that Boston Globe piece, because when I was initially researching this matter, that's what kind of comes up first. And then I'm so grateful that you sent me all of these amazing letters from people supporting you. So I was able to get a much clearer perspective. But it's incredibly difficult when there's one news article online that says something that's untrue, and that's kind of where everybody's going to get their information. And what I noticed in your case is that the Boston Globe article mentioned something about a hostile work environment, which, as you say, isn't true. And then people were then taking that to mean that it was like a Me Too thing. Like the energy that can happen online in terms of someone's reputation is so toxic. And when I was first becoming aware of this, I didn't know where to go to find the truth of the matter. So reading your letter on your website and then reading all of these letters to you, it was really helpful for me to understand the full picture of what actually happened to you. And I'm really sorry that you have this awful experience of horrible news articles online about you. And it sounds like you're not able to really correct them or have them take it down, or?
No, once something is out, we see that in the politics all the time, somebody lies and then that becomes a supposed fact. I actually have very little idea how this has affected me. In that, my book became the best-selling book in psychiatry in the last 30 years or something. And so, and the people who know me never believed any of this stuff. So my own personality hasn't been much affected by it. And I really don't follow what people are saying out there. People keep inviting me to do things, et cetera, et cetera. So while I imagine some people have taken it seriously, I don't quite know. For me, the main issue was that the work was destroyed and all the people who were treating, all the research that we're doing was basically destroyed. And that was the sad thing about it. So, of course, what happened when the Boston Globe wrote this article, they called me up. It's the same day that it happened. And I was completely flustered. And rather than saying, man, this is a bunch of crap and this is nonsense, I was too overwhelmed by what had just happened to actually say very much. So they just said he was too, you know, there wasn't any defense there. And once it's in the news, it spread all over the world, actually. Like, I got letters from Japan and India because the little article had been replicated everywhere else in Europe. I mean, I got letters. I got hundreds and hundreds of letters, like, what the hell's happening to you? Because it went viral, basically. But overall, I'm not sure how this affected my life, basically. Because the people who know me. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Well, and I was grateful to get to read all of these letters. They're very touching. And I don't think that they're available publicly, but I appreciate you making them available to me privately to be able to read them before this interview. And they all paint the same picture, really, is that you are someone who really nurtured excellence in people, but didn't bully people or make people feel bad. And then when we hear the actual story, it was all about someone else's behavior that then was attributed to you. It's just such a shame.
The piece is the cynicism. Because the guy who fired me knew that I hadn't done anything. But what his supervisee had done was really pretty bad. And that he tried to get the legal responsibility for that off his shoulders. Because he was in danger of getting fired. Because he has had numerous complaints over the years, which I didn't know about this guy's misbehavior. And he had not done anything until it was too late. And so he decided, okay, better get rid of him so that people will think that he did the bad thing rather than me.
Mm. To bring it just back to your work in trauma, you can go through something that's traumatic and painful, and that can actually stimulate a kind of overcoming and a kind of post-traumatic growth experience. And I wonder, in a situation like this, how might someone, if they were in your shoes, if someone is going through this, how might they take an experience like this and use it to actually grow and become more open-hearted? Because I think the instinct is to be, when something like this happens, which is a traumatizing event of being accused in this way and having your trauma center that you created essentially collapse because of that, there's a lot of pain and the trauma in that. So how does one grow through something like that?
Well, as the expression goes, you become a sadder but wiser person. I've never been a fan of post-traumatic growth. You know, like, I always think it's a little bit gilding the lily. But what I found in myself and the people who, my colleagues to whom this has happened, is that, you know, we have this life force. And that is really part of trauma, is that some of the most creative people I've ever met are traumatized people. And so you need to find new solutions. And it's that life force that helps you to carry on and finding new solutions. Oprah Winfrey, Nelson Mandela, these famous people all came out of trauma. But I wouldn't call it post-traumatic growth because the pain is there. You know, it leaves its traces. It's not like, oh, and you'd ride off in the sunset after this, you know? Mm.
Well, Bessel, I really appreciate you taking some time to talk about this experience that you went through. Is there anything else that you want to share with our audience about what happened with the trauma center before we leave this today?
Enough. No, the sad thing, and it's very much I'd like to encourage the clinical people who are in the field who listen to this, is that when you become academic, you tend to go by these little descriptions like they're in the DSM. Like the MDMA field trial, we look at the outcome of psychedelics on the DSM symptoms. But these little descriptions are so small compared to the complexity of human lives. And you really don't know the complexity about human lives unless you really see other human beings and get to know them extremely well. And so my great message is that even though at the end my center was destroyed where we combined these two, I would urge anybody out there who does research, and actually my next phone call is about a piece of research that somebody wants to do, where we really encompass the complexity of human beings in what we measure and what we look at. Because if we go to too many pre conceived notions about what goes on with people, we may miss the forest for the trees.
Mm. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Bessel. Thanks for coming back on the show and taking a little extra time with me. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks very much, Akim, Eamon. Okay. Be well. Okay. Bye-bye.
You too. Take care.